Okay, so great to see so much people here. I welcome you all to the 2025 Top Cyber Threats. So I'm Kevin and I'm here with my team Los Fuzzies. And today we are going to present like the most interesting security vulnerabilities from 2025. So before we start, just a small slide about us. Who are we? We are a student Capture the Flag team from DEO Graz. And we are participating, teaching, playing, and organizing so-called CTF events. From those of you who have been here yesterday in the workshop, know us already. So we are playing challenges and organizing some of the CTFs. So we are a student team which has been created more than 10 years ago, we are heavily tied to the institute who is researching in this area, and we are more than 20 active members. And as already mentioned before, we are supported by university, the institute, and also by some companies. So that's from information from our side. And now we'll start with the CVEs. So each of us will present CVEs today. And I'm going to start with the first one, with the so-called Husky vulnerability, which is a vulnerability discovered in WordPress. So as a short overview, what is this? This is a plugin in the WordPress ecosystem, which is called Husky, Products Filter Professionals for WooCommerce. And all this plugin does is it's allowing you to like give you more possibility of filtering information within a WooCommerce webshop. And it has roughly like 90,000 active installations. And in March 25, there was a vulnerability discovered. And there was a so-called local file inclusion vulnerability. We'll see later what this means, which can lead to remote code execution, which is unauthorized. So if you know the website of someone who uses this plugin, it doesn't need you to log in. You can just take over the whole WordPress server. Just by someone has installed this plugin, it is vulnerable to this. And we are now looking a bit into what went wrong there. So in WordPress, you often have such calls, WordPress Ajax, which allows the plugin developer to like provide a service over to make accessible with JavaScript calls. This was used in the plugin for like filtering out stuff. And we can see here there is like a mentioned a WooCommerce function text search, which was implemented by this function. And if we go a bit through the source code, we can see here that we have our options, which has been passed by the request itself. And here is a bit of a problem. So the template here is used for loading a template function or a template file for displaying the stuff afterwards. And what is happening here is that we are fetching this with our options, which can't be controlled by the user. And it's building a path like this. And if the file does not exist, it's just falling back to the template variable itself. So why does this matter? The problem here is that with the template here, we don't have any input sanitizer. So we can just escape this path here with a dot, dot, slash, dot, dot, and whatever. We can like read any arbitrary file. And especially in the next here, we have an apply filter where this template is used and where it's rendering an HTML file. And all this function does, basically, it's allowing you to include an arbitrary file. So to summary a bit, we can see that the exploit, what someone can do is like control the whole template variable and include, which then gets afterwards included into the file. So, and if the file doesn't exist, it's falling back to the whole template, so we can fully control it now, and then it's afterwards included. So this allows us to arbitrarily read and read files and run code. And here we have an example of the exploit. So what someone is doing, we have a template option here, which just like throw a bunch of folder escapes with dot dot slash. And afterwards, we are pointing him to an Apache log. The reason for this, we see it in the next slide. However, in the user agent, we set like a PHP code. And then we send it, and we get the response. Why do we use the Apache server for this? Well, Apache web servers, the access logs, is used to log like web requests. And it stores information like the method, the path, and the user agent. And if you think about here is the user agent. So what if we now say, OK, we, for example, set the user agent to be like a PHP script. And this is what is happening. So if we send the request to the server like here before, with like this path here, this file gets included, and every PHP statement gets then executed, allowing the attacker to fully like control the server. In this case, we have here the system ID, which is making a system call, which is opening a shell and running ID. And here we can see that this comment has been executed. This like an exploit script, and then this then leads to like remote code execution. All right. Thank you, and now we have Marcel talking about MongoBleed.
Yeah, thank you, Kevin. So I'm talking about the CVE 2025 14847 MongoBleed. Some people maybe have a foreboding with the name what might happen here. So let's begin with what actually is MongoDB. So MongoDB is a non-relational document database. So instead of like relational databases that are organized in rows and columns, it stores documents. And it's available under a source available license, so it's not fully free and open source. The documents are stored in BSON, which is a binary JSON format. And MongoDB has quite a lot of features. For example, it adheres to ACID. It supports sharding and replication and a lot more features. But in itself, it's quite useless if we cannot access it in any way. So we have to have a wire format, and we have to send data over TCP. And this is how the data structure looks like that is sent if we want to do a request on the MongoDB server. So it has the message length, an ID, response to, which is not relevant for us now, and an opcode. And the opcode itself says what the request is doing. So it changes the behavior and what other content the MongoDB server is expecting. And there are quite a few opcodes it has. However, most of them are deprecated in favor of OP message, which is doing pretty much everything now. We are also not talking about OP message today, but about OP compressed. So you can also send compressed messages to the server. And in that case, the server also expects the original opcode, which is usually OP message. And it also expects the uncompressed size, the compressor ID, so which compression algorithm was used to compress the data, and of course the data itself. And yeah, for now we'll look into how clip compressed data goes through the MongoDB server. So after some async I/O and future stuff, at some point, our request will land here in session workflow impl dispatch work. And here we have a call to decompress request, which interestingly happens always, regardless of whether the message is compressed or not. And inside the function, it checks if it's compressed or not. If not, we just return and do as nothing happened. And otherwise, we try to decompress the message with the compressor manager. And the first things we do here is to pass the header and do some plausibility checks, which is pretty fine. And then we look for the compressor itself. And after a while, we will here determine the size of the data by using the uncompressed size from the header plus the header size and allocate a buffer here. Next, we finally can do the actual decompression. And we also have to do a check if we actually got as much data as it was announced to be. So so the compressor here is expected to return the size of the data that was actually decompressed. Okay, for Clib, it looks like this. So at first, we store the length. Then we call uncompress, check if everything went okay, and then we return the length of our output. Wait. We have a few lengths here. And so we have the length from the output, we have length at the variable, and we have the input length. So if we look into the uncompress function in the documentation, we see here that in destlang, it stores after the compression the size of the data that has been decompressed. So basically, here in length, we have stored how much data was was in the decompressed size. We are not doing anything with length here, are we? We just return output.length. And output.length is just the buffer size that we allocated, that was given in the header, and not the size that we actually decompressed. So this check here outside that checks if we have enough data decompressed is basically useless. So what we did is a completely tautological check. So all the assertions that we did before, basically for nothing. So why is this a problem? Usually, we have a problem with too much data if we have an overflow. But too little data? The problem is in the heap, because shared buffer alloc that is used here is basically a wrapper around the SCD allocator. And it just does under the hood a malloc. So it gets a data chunk from the heap. And we can store some data inside. If we free it again, the data is not cleared. So if it happens that another malloc returns the same chunk, we just get the same data that we had before. And if we just decompress too little data here, and the function claims that we still have compressed the full buffer size, we have too much data here. So this is absolutely not fine. So how can we use that? We can just say that we have an OP message, and we can create a BSON fragment that just pretends to be, that is just enough so that the data that follows, that we have not overwritten, looks like it's another key in the BSON data. And the MongoDB parser will read until the Bison parser will read the key until the next null. And everything about that is interpreted as a key. And, well, some garbage data the MongoDB parser will not understand. So it will return an error and say, this key is absolutely invalid. What should I do with it? So with that, we can just leak a lot of data out of the heap. And by doing that with a lot of different parameters and different timings, we can leak quite a lot of data out. So we can leak out user data, for example, results from old runs, or possibly also credentials that are stored in the program memory, or also logs. And luckily for us, there is also an implementation of proof of concept by Joe Desimon. And what it does is basically just send a probe, which gets us all responses, so all the data that the function found. And later on, we just try to get out the data from the Bison. And sendprobe itself just creates this minimal Bison structure, which just says it is an integer with the label A and a 32-bit value of 1. Later, we also compress it so that we actually have an OP compressed message and just send it away. And for the extraction, we actually just have to decompress the message if it is compressed, because the server does not have to have the response compressed. And then we just look for some data that looks, well, that looks good to us. And I tried to run that on a completely fresh Docker container. And you can see we can leak out quite a lot of data here already. That's likely a lot of log data, but in a completely running MongoDB instance, there will be some spicy data here. So this is the story of MongoBleed, which is, as I said before, CVE 1484.7, or in the EU vulnerability database 25204529. It has a score of 8.7 and was internally found by MongoDB's security engineering team. It was discovered on the 12th of December, 2025, and they patched it from the 15th to the 17th. And 2 days later, they published the CVE. It also took 3 days longer to actually get a patch out, and the vulnerability was known to be exploited by 29. And also, a lot of versions were affected. And the fix, you ask? Well, it's just quite a lot of tests and one single line. And with that, I hand over to React.shell.
Thank you. So the next vulnerability is quite well known, what I think. It's the CVE 2025-551A2. And it's more known as the React2Shell vulnerability. So for that, what is even React? React is like nowadays one of the most popular JavaScript frameworks for building websites. You have like different components in there which were basically responsible that stuff was vulnerable in React. For example, the React server components, which are basically parts of a website that only run on the server, which has some advantages because you can do direct access to a database, so which you should never do on the client. Yeah. And how the whole stuff works is you basically have data, you pack function arguments and parameters on the client, send them via HTTP, the server unpacks them and then runs the function. If the unpacking is flawed, we have a problem because the attacker can then execute arbitrary commands or code on the server. the whole exchange is based on a JSON-like protocol, which is named React Flight. In this protocol, you basically have named data fields, and you have different chunks. And fields can reference other chunks with links. So for example, if you put a $1 there, you can say go to chunk 1, get its value. For example, you have like one chunk here with city Graz. You can say, yeah, go to chunk 1, take the city, so we resolve to Graz. There are also other things which were not necessarily needed for the exploit. This, like the whole logic, is in a function in the server which is called getOutlineModel. And this starts referencing or resolving all these references, and it's also splitting on colon. But it never actually checks what it is. So for that, we now need a bit of background in JavaScript. JavaScript is quite well known in browsers. Now it's also more and more used in backends. And you basically store data as key value pairs. So for example, you create an object named LinuxTage. You can dereference the name again of the object, like the field name of the object, and you get LinuxTage. There's also something you can call, which is .constructor, which basically gives you like the more high-level thing. I don't know how to properly explain that. But I think the example shows it quite well. For example, here you have a string. You call .constructor, you get a string. And if you have something like this, for example, an array, a string or so, you can call constructor again, and you get the function. And with that function, you can execute any arbitrary JavaScript code. So that's now the getOutlineModel function in React. So here is like the reference split, which is colon, colon, or which splits on colon. So if you add multiple colons, you get like different pair of fields. You can absolutely control the path, since you can just create like a mocked object, which you throw in there, and then you basically just create something like this, have constructor, constructor, and you basically dereference twice there, like value constructor. Then you have like, for example, a string, then you do like another constructor, and you're back at the function level. And with that, you can basically achieve complete code execution. So here is like a better example of this. You have like an array, value constructor, you get the array. You call constructor again on this, you have the function, and then React calls the attacker's code. So to get now a fully complete working exploit for React to shell, you basically first create like fake data, which mimics React internal data structures. For example, you can use a promise or something like this, and you just send it to the server. Then you need to somehow trick React to reach the function constructor, which we saw earlier. You just do constructor, constructor. You create a chunk, which is like an array. And then you say, we take the chunk 3 and call constructor, constructor on it. And then we have like the React pattern again, array function. And then we can just call function with our own code. This was exploited in the wild. Like, there is proof of this. F5 Labs did some research. They analyzed some traffic, and they also figured out what was happening. You could just do like a simple check if the server is actually vulnerable by just writing some text to a public file. Then you can read the file again, and you see if you then have like, is my hero in the file, you know that the server is still vulnerable. This was also used for botnet malware download, for example, Rondodox, which was used for mass infection of random servers and then to spread malware, where you just basically try wget. You have curl, you have busybox wget, just some alternatives if like the server doesn't have wget or so installed, and then you have basically achieved your own scripts running on the server. You could also just create a simple reversal. You create a named pipe and do like a netcat listen on this. So, since this sounds quite bad, it was quite bad. This had like a CVSS base score of 10, which is like the maximum you can get. Congratulations to React. You didn't need any login, and any attacker can basically exploit this remotely. You don't need any auth. you were even vulnerable if you did like a simple, you followed the official documentation, did a simple create React app, deployed it. Yeah, you were vulnerable. This was reported on the 29th of November. Took 4 days to patch and disclose, which is super fast. And then also they disclosed it, and then it was exploited in the wild, because as soon as the vulnerability is out, you cannot patch instantly, sadly. So there were multiple affected versions, not only in React, because Next.js is basically server-side rendered React, was also affected, and multiple other NPM packages like React Router, Vaku, from Basel, some Vue.js. Yeah. And patches were like out quite soon in this React versions and this Next.js versions. So how do you now fix this? You just add a simple check, has own property call value path I. So you only allow access to direct properties and not inherit that ones. Here's an example. For example, we do like has own property call on an array constructor, we get like a false. So we basically block the constructor call in this, which solves the whole problem of escalating it to a function. Has own property call city grad still works because this is not the direct property of it. Or is a direct property of it. Yeah. Some vendors also, for example, Cloudflare had like in their web application firewall, they deployed like a new change to directly block on the network level. This turns out they somehow went down for like 3 hours or so because they made a mistake in there. Yeah. So that's also not always the best solution. And with that, I will hand over to Sebastian to see what you can do with it.
If it runs on Fedora.
Well, thanks, Andy. Which is the correct button now? Yes, very great. So the first vulnerability that I will talk about is the abort root on Fedora systems. Yay. Well, this is an automated bug reporting tool which runs as a system service, obviously. And because why not? It's basically an HTTP server. Well, not basically, it is one with a socket where everyone on the system, or rather every program, can write to it and just submit any report. Okay, that sounds great. The bug was present for 10 years before it was discovered. You will see why, but it's great. So, also, the file name's awesome. That's some very good enterprise software right there. Anyways, so scanf should be quite reasonable. We just get the container ID. So the bug was about like extracting a container ID from mount infos. However, what's really nice is it would run whether Docker or not was installed anyways. And if you can see the sprintf and you have done any C programming, what shouldn't you do with printf or snprintf? Well, obviously, just passing %s with some container ID. That's not vulnerable by itself. However, since we all somewhat know Linux systems, right? That's still a user-controlled input that's not verified against if that Docker container even exists or anything like that. So we can just pass arbitrary commands there, which is, well, it doesn't have any sanitization. So what we can do is, essentially what this does is it simply executes docker inspect and then our inserted command. So by crafting a fake mount info with a malicious overlay path, essentially an attacker can control 12 bytes of the container ID field and just pass it in there. So we get a command. However, we can only run this command essentially with, well, 12 bytes. That's not a lot. However, we still get command injection as root. Very nice. So, what do we do with 12 bytes? That's actually not a lot, and it's not very good. And we are not allowed to have any spaces, any forward slashes, and we can only have some limited special characters. Also, we are running in the systemd sandbox. However, what do? We just multi-stage an exploit. So, first stage. someone figured out, we will get to the POC a bit later, well, we can simply, within those 12 bytes, exactly do a printf, then a space, which we use tab as, because we aren't allowed to have any spaces in there, and then pipe a character, in our case x, into a file. So we just redirect the printf into a file. So why this is great is a full shell script can be written at slash q as root if we just run this multiple times. So we just submit reports over and over again, and it simply appends our second exploit. Fucking awesome. Okay, so great. We have another payload. So what can we do? The second stage needs to reference absolute paths because, well, we are running in a sandbox and our environment variables are a bit stripped. So what we can do is we are not allowed to have any forward spaces in the 12-byte limit as well. However, what's great is since we are running in a sandbox, dollar PVD, which is our working directory, is set to slash. You see where I'm getting at. With a simple substitution, we can simply into the script say slash home slash lowprif slash final essentially. And, well, this would now get executed. We don't need any slashes for that. So, and very simple, we just essentially with the character for character bypass, or rather building of our exploit, we just write this in there into our file, which is just a user-controlled file. And into that now user-controlled file, we can use a systemd sandbox escape, which is just this command, this is known. And, well, this spawns a new transient service outside of the abort's restricted unit. However, this one now has this flag set, protect system full, so etc sudo us is now writable. Quite simple. So we just add our lowprif users to slash etc sudo us, and we just elevated ourselves like some local lowprif account to full root on our system by just sending a few stupid HTTP requests. Awesome. So thanks to Fedora for that one. Passwordless root access. Awesome. So this was reported quite recently. However, it still took 2 months, which is recently, and then only the embargo lifted. It's really nice. Discovered by initstring, obviously, who has a POC for it as well. But yeah, so, and the second CV, because, well, in 2025, not enough server applications have been exploited, so Redis also. Redis is an in-memory key-value storage, which is open source and written in C. And most applications just use it as a cache between their backend and the frontend, or like some data. You can also use it as a message broker if you don't like RabbitMQ or stuff like that. And obviously, because every good database needs a scripting language, it has an interpreter, like a Lua interpreter, embedded into it. Great. What's also really nice is if you just install Redis by itself, auth is disabled by default, so maybe only run it within like VPNs or internal networks which don't have access to the outside internet directly. Okay, why this is awesome is there is this eval command which you can send to the server, which evaluates a Lua script. However, this script runs inside the Lua sandbox. And it should be isolated from the host. However, well, it somewhat works quite well. And obviously, this bug has been present for 13 years because no one has found it yet, or before that. So every call, or eval call instruction, reaches the Lua Y parser in the Lua parser. OK, so what this does is just it sets an input. And it allocates some memory, in our case, Lua string new, which allocates a T string for the chunk name and passes it to the Lua further parser. However, the issue now is it never anchors it on the Lua stack. So it just allocates some memory, never tells essentially anybody else about it, and calls further functions. So why is this an issue? Most database systems have their own garbage collector, very similar to, Java and other high-level programming languages, which keep track of memory automatically. Redis, and in that case Lua, uses a mark and sweep garbage collector. So the garbage collector only keeps objects alive if they are either reachable from our global tables, which are like Lua globals, the Lua stack itself, or other specific GC routes. So the issue is, essentially, our T string is only allocated within a local C variable, but the garbage collector is not aware of it and cannot see it. So if some malicious script now triggers the garbage collection while passing the other Lua functions further down, the garbage collector runs, finds this T string variable, and just frees it. And the whole Lua parsing and lexing continues, dereferences a free pointer, and we get a very nice use of the free. Here's a visualization again. We just allocate the T string, pass it further. It's not on the stack, the garbage collector is not aware of it. Then we have to craft a script where the garbage collector triggers mid script. It's not breachable, freed, done, boom. Memory corruption. Great. So now what we can do with it is, we have a memory corruption. Why don't we escape the Lua sandbox and get native remote code execution? Sounds like a good plan, right? Sadly, there are not many proof of concepts available for this because, this exploit was very dangerous. And, at least there are only some of them. And we won't show any of them because we have checked on Shodan before. Still a lot of servers, quite reachable and vulnerable, pretty bad. So what's the fix? Well, you literally anchor on the stack so the garbage collector sees it. Which you just say, okay, great, this local variable now, we want to keep track of it. Essentially, we just keep track of it, increase a ref count, boom, done, the garbage collector is aware of it, and we decrease the stack balance again. Great. If you're interested about the proof of concept to check if your server is vulnerable, it's like this. Essentially, Redis will crash if it's vulnerable, and what this does is simply it hammers exactly what we talked about, which is just we allocate some strings, like a lot of them, and try to crash the server by getting the garbage collector to free something that we have to use later. And that's how you can check it remotely against the server. The POC link is up there to check if your server is vulnerable. And yeah, luckily it was patched quite recently after like a quite long delay. Some people from Wiz Research actually exploited this service at Pontoon in Berlin in 2025. And it took Redis 5 months to not only issue a CVE, but also a patch. And presumably, not only is that quite a long time, but yeah, you know, maybe it should have been a bit faster, given the fix is like, So, yeah, great. But for that, we are now going to the last exploit from Leo.
Okay, let's first define what a zero-click exploit chain is. It's a combination of vulnerabilities to cross multiple security boundaries and gain remote code execution and low privilege escalation on a target via remotely accessible entry vector requiring no user interaction. The remote attack surface is defined by whatever services are running on the target that automatically process incoming data. Every step needs to be good enough to defeat defense-in-depth countermeasures. And even if we get a successful step in the exploit chain, we still need to obtain capabilities in a limited and sandboxed environment, which means that we need bypasses for example, stuff like AppArmor or, say, Linux, or a sandbox escape. There's also privilege separation, which requires kernel exploit, low privilege escalation. Would this mean a full compromise? No, because persistence is still not granted. So after a reboot, our privileged state would reset, and therefore we would need an exploit of the bootloader, of the trusted execution environment, or of the put a firmware implant, and this would give us a full chain with persistence, because a bootloader and, for example, the kernel has integrity checks. The use case of zero-click exploit chains are simply to deploy spyware. There's no other way to put it. The attack surface usually is hardened over time and tends to be reduced. Attackers know it very well, developers as well. Recently, however, there has been the trend of LLM parsing everything we have on our phones, and this brought AI-powered message analysis. Of course, we also need to interpret attachments, and thus we have automatic decoding of media attachments, and media decoders enter the zero-click attack surface. An example of this is SMS and RCS audio attachments received by Google Messages. The media decoders are traditionally a very fertile attack surface. They are massively complex, have C++ for performance reasons. They perform input parsing, which makes them good fuzzing targets. And historically, they even were privileged on sandbox. However, not anymore. Developers did actually do their homework. CVEs for media decoders were released in 2025. Google Project Zero started doing research on them. Researchers, however, questioned whether you can actually get code, whether the code execution you get in a media decoder is useful to find to gain root access, since this would require very hard to find exploits to have a full chain, and probably only the best attackers that have like a pile of bugs could pull it off. Google Project Zero takes on this challenge and wants to prove that this is possible. What is Google Project Zero? It's a team of security researchers at Google who study zero-day vulnerabilities in the hardware and software systems that everybody is dependent on. And their mission is to make the discovery of exploitation of security vulnerabilities more difficult, to significantly improve the safety and security of the internet for everyone. They found two, which led to this zero-click exploit chain. Now, two bugs is actually not a lot, so these media decoders are good targets. They have released three blog posts. I think they're really good, also as a resource to learn about this kind of exploit. So how does it work? Well, we need a media decoder. A very good target is Dolby Unified Decoder. Almost nobody uses it, but it's everybody everywhere anyway. The library that provides support for Dolby audio formats. At some point, it defines the EMDF, which is some struct inside it. It has a structure that carries audio metadata. The decoder scans a buffer constructed from various audio blocks, and at some point it finds a sync word, which finds the EMDF, and then the EMDF contains various metadata. One of this is EMDF payload size. This is not checked for size. If we overflow, we will get a very small allocation because we overflow, but the while loop still uses a very large value. Thus, we have integer overflow, and usually integer overflows are difficult to exploit because they lead to huge writes, which then would fail because huge writes fail usually, and or the loop would run forever. But there's a useful loop exit on failure feature available inside the program. So by having some other field in the struct such that it fails early, they can just exit early. Then we have some write primitive on a custom Evo heap. So basically the audio decoder has a custom heap, which makes it actually more easy, because usually you would require heap grooming and a lot of luck to make a heap exploit work. But in this case, with a custom allocator, we have no free and no metadata, more deterministic. Then we perform a heap feng shui, which is a bit complex, but ASLR would actually block us here, And also the fact that it's a zero-click exploit makes this infeasible. We could do two things, do a partial Poisson overwrite from behind, so just overwrite nibbles, or do a relative write. So this is actually solved using nibble guessing, and this needs to overwrite some nibble, and then the heap choreography lands. Eventually, we achieve ROP, return-oriented programming. ROP tends to be very tedious, could be done with ROP, but shellcode is better. Say Linux actually blocks usual routes via mprotect, so usually we just put the shellcode in some buffer and call mprotect, but Say Linux blocks this. DLOpen, same thing. What could we do? Libc functions are also limited, the ones which we have available. There is a very creative solution using proc self mem, which is usually used for debugging, and we patch it with the available syscalls and a very convenient ROP gadget. Basically, we spray FDs using fopen, and we can guess the FD. We pre-write a shellcode on stack check fail, and then call that, and then we can actually call the shellcode. However, another nibble guess is necessary, and thus we reduce the probability to 1/256. This is still viable in this context. We then need low privilege escalation. We do this with a big wave driver. This is hardware inside the pixel system on a chip that accelerates AV1 decoding tasks. A process uses the IOCTL, this enum, define, and it places a job on a queue, basically for decoding, and then a separate kernel thread comes in and takes care of the job. There is, however, an object lifetime mismatch via race condition, thus we get a user after free. We have a fixed size, large arbitrary write, which usually leads to stability issues, but the researcher actually realized that that this was not a big problem, and for data exfiltration, it's usually viable. We need still to defeat KSLR, but we can just do nothing at all, because since 2016 on Pixel devices, the kernel neural map base is not properly randomized, so we can just use this address for the data section, which works, but we still need code execution in the kernel. Therefore, we need a text section, actually, and there's control flow integrity enabled, so we can't really use any pointer inside the text section. We need verified pointers, and we do this by forging VFS FOPS handler. This is a technique that the researcher describes quite well, that has been used for other exploits as well. And we read proc self mount to leak the real text pointers, which gives us a bypass for CFI. Then we use some kind of type confusion in HMM-MISC, and we gain our arbitrary read-write inside the kernel. Then we set, say, Linux to permissive. We fork a new process, overwrite its task threads. We have a root, and say Linux is disabled. Now, the full chain is a message that contains multiple corrupt .mp4 attachments. The first exploit delivers shellcode. It requires syscall wrappers to strip libc dependency and to shrink the ELF to make it more reliable. And this was like very tedious to write, so the researcher used an LLM to write a syscall wrapper, and it worked really well, so there's that. And maybe attackers will use it in the future as well, maybe it will make exploitation easier. Finally, there is a script that takes a screenshot and sends it to an IP address as POC. What are the limitations here? Well, it works only 1/256 times. Every time it takes 3 seconds, thus it's doable in total in 6 minutes, which still makes it viable for, since it's zero click, the person would not notice it. The first exploit actually works on most Android devices, even on a Samsung. It's blocked on iOS and Mac due to the F-bound safety compiler flag. This is a defense in depth measure that would introduce a performance penalty because it has additional checks. But it's actually very easy to implement. They could just enable it. And Apple has done so. This programmer, this developer at Apple did so, and he prevented CVE from happening. We could also have disabled proc self mem, but this is actually a very creative way to perform the exploit, so it was not necessary. So in general, I would say I wouldn't disable it. It should be disabled by default since debug is not used. Also, seccomp was missing on the Pixel 9, and that would have actually blocked pwrite, and that would have made the exploit a lot harder to implement. There's also the big topic of MTE and MIE, a memory target extension, or how Apple calls it, memory integrity enforcement. It's a probabilistic countermeasure for the second exploit, for the kernel exploit. It would add a tag to every memory access because the pointers are tagged in hardware. Ironically, this is actually available on Pixel 8 Plus, so also on the Pixel 9, but it's disabled by default. Google could have done it. They actually invested a lot of money in research on this topic. And this means that whatever I just talked about, you know, in the future, it might not be so easy to find exploits like this, because with MTE and MIE, it's the dawn of memory violations, and then we will have to look more at race conditions, side channels, and other exploits that might allow us to still gain zero-click attack chains. So now for the outro, this was just a tiny selection. Actually, there were so many vulnerabilities, 48,244 CVEs reported throughout 2025. And that was it.